Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
How did we grow our business internationally? Expand our production facilities. Make new connections and secure financing to go from this to this? We saw the future, and Export Development Canada helped us map the way.
Looking to grow your business globally? Confidently enter new markets, reduce financial risk, and grow your business with Export Development Canada. Discover the export impact at edc.ca today.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Friday, the 26th of May, these are our main stories. Artificial intelligence is used to develop a new antibiotic. Far-right militia leader Stuart Rhodes is sentenced to 18 years in jail for seditious conspiracy following the attack on the US Capitol in 2021. A big upsurge in investment in clean energy. Also in this podcast, more than a dozen civilians face trial in a Pakistani military court as the army seeks to prosecute opposition supporters involved in recent unrest. And why killer whales are sinking boats off the Iberian coast.
It's like when we get up in the morning and do some coffee. When an orca gets up, the orca thinks I have to swim 50 kilometers, for example. I have to eat and I have to stop some boats.
We begin with an exciting scientific breakthrough that's been made possible thanks to artificial intelligence. Researchers in the US and Canada have used AI to discover a new antibiotic that can kill a particularly dangerous superbug. Dr. Jonathan Stokes is from McMaster University.
AI enhances the rate and, in a perfect world, decreases the cost with which we can discover these new structural and functional classes of antibiotics that we desperately need. It's not a panacea. It's not going to solve all of our problems, but it's a remarkably powerful and dynamic tool.
I've been hearing about the research from our science correspondent, James Gallagher.
They're looking at just one superbug. So they're looking at one of the superbugs that the World Health Organization puts in its top three in terms of critical threats around the world. And it's called Acinetobacter baumannii. Now, not many people have heard of it, but it is quite nasty. It can cause pneumonia. It lingers in hospitals and care homes. And it often is resistant and shrugs off the effects of many of the antibiotics that we already have. So that's why they wanted to develop a new one. So in order to go about doing that, they first needed to train the AI. So what they do is they test some drugs that they already have and they go, does this drug slow down the growth of this superbug or not? And so they do that over lots of different drugs, and they know the precise chemical structure of all of those drugs. So they just bash all of that information into the AI, and it goes, It doesn't literally hum, Val. But what it's learning to do is figure out which are the important bits of chemistry that interfere with the growth of this bacterium. The next stage is to go, well, here's our vault of drugs that we don't know whether they work yet or not. And the AI interrogates the chemical structure of this massive vault of drugs that you've already got and goes, this is the couple of hundred that I think are most likely to work out of the thousands and thousands and thousands that are in there. That took about an hour and a half. So researchers basically went, oh, you've done my shortlisting for me. We'll test your best ones in the lab. And that's how they ended up finding one that was incredibly potent, as well as eight other potential antibiotics, by basically getting an AI to do a lot of the donkey work for them so they could only concentrate on the ones that were most likely to work.
Well, it sounds like an extraordinary breakthrough in terms of time, if nothing else.
There's kind of like two breakthroughs here, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you know, we've talked many times about how we are desperately short of new antibiotics, how there's not been a new class of antibiotics for decades, how more than a million people each year die from infections that can't be treated successfully with antibiotics. So you've got that side of it, but also AI revolutionising drug development and basically massively speeding up the process. I mean, you can get to a point where you could have an AI interrogating hundreds of millions of potential drug compounds that have been hypothesized or developed in a lab. But you could never test that against every drug, but you could get an AI to filter through, go, which ones should we actually bother investing the time in? So we don't know if this drug is ever going to make it into clinical practice. It has to go through all the next stage of research now. They've identified it in the lab, but you need to test it to make sure it's safe to give to people and all that kind of stuff. So I think the real breakthrough here is the one that you picked out as kind of like how AI really shifts the dial and puts rockets basically on drug discovery and speeds it up massively.
James Gallagher. Stuart Rhodes, the founder of a far-right extremist group, the Oath Keepers, has been sentenced to prison for 18 years for orchestrating the attack on the US Capitol in January 2021. More than 2,000 people entered the Capitol building, spurred on by false claims that the 2020 presidential election had been rigged against Donald Trump and in favor of Joe Biden. The judge, Amit Mehta, said Stuart Rhodes presented an ongoing threat and peril to the country and the very fabric of democracy. Ed Tarpley, a lawyer for Stuart Rhodes, said they had a good case for appeal on the grounds of free speech.
This case was all about the weaponization of speech by the Department of Justice. Essentially, they have used Stuart Rhodes' words against him. It was not what his actions were, but it was his words. He never went into the Capitol. He never assaulted anyone. He never destroyed any property. We argued all those matters during the trial and post-trial. Clearly, the words of Stuart Rhodes is what the judge returned to time and time again.
Our correspondent in Washington, Jessica Parker, has more.
Stuart Rhodes was found guilty of seditious conspiracy, which is this Civil War era charge that actually hasn't successfully been used since the 1990s. So he was convicted at the back end of last year, and now we've learnt that a federal judge has sentenced him to 18 years in prison. Prosecutors had actually sought a longer sentence, 25 years, but 18 years is what he's been given. In court, we understand he was pretty defiant, saying that he was a political prisoner, something that the judge really wasn't having anything of, basically suggesting he still presented a peril to the country. In terms of what happened during the course of the trial, he wasn't the only member of the Oath Keepers who was on trial, and we expect some further sentencing over the coming days. But he is the leader of this far-right militia group. And while he didn't personally go into the Capitol on January 6th, he was accused by prosecutors of essentially coordinating things via messages from outside the Capitol building. So I think this will be seen as a highly significant conviction and sentencing. Also worth bearing in mind, I mean, this isn't just a matter of kind of rattling through these cases following January 6th. Donald Trump, the former president, who, of course, wants to re-enter the White House, when he was asked recently during a CNN town hall conversation he was having whether he would pardon Jan 6th rioters, he basically suggested he would look to pardon at least some, if not most of them. So this is a current political issue as well as a judicial one.
Jessica Parker. The European police agency Europol has broken up a violent criminal gang from the Western Balkans after carrying out simultaneous raids in seven countries. 37 people have been arrested. I got more details from our Balkans correspondent, Guy Deloney.
Europol describes the gang as a highly violent criminal cell, and they say they're responsible for the large-scale trafficking of drugs and firearms across Europe. So some of the other details that Europol have released, that the suspected leader of this criminal cell is from Bosnia and Herzegovina, and he's currently in jail in Italy. And they say they believe he was actually coordinating the gang's activities from prison, regularly giving orders and instructions to other members of the gang on matters relating to the trafficking of drugs and firearms. And this really was a sort of international affair within the region. Among those arrested, for example, by police in Croatia during this operation, included citizens from Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and Serbia, all arrested in Croatia as part of this operation. And police made arrests in six other countries as well.
So a huge operation, and it must have meant cooperation between many countries.
Absolutely, it did. And it also involved cooperation with the US Drug Enforcement Agency. This is actually just the latest of a series of operations that Europol have been involved in. Based on data, the law enforcement agencies have been able to extract from a formerly encrypted communication service called SkyECC. And that seems to have been used by a lot of criminal groups, but law enforcement agencies cracked its encryption a couple of years ago, and it's been providing them with a rich bounty.
Do we know why these criminal gangs have emerged in the Balkans? Is it to do with a lot of the arms washing around after the wars there in the 90s?
There is certainly a long history of arms being trafficked through the Western Balkans. That's for sure. And as you say, the arms have been washing around, and there's always been quite a large-scale cooperation among criminal elements in the countries of the Western Balkans to traffic arms from this region through into Central, Western and Northern Europe. I think that's quite well known. This particular gang seems to have specialised more in drugs than in firearms, judging by what's been seized by the police. There were firearms which were seized, including two machine guns plus explosives, but they were much more interested in the heroin, the cocaine and the marijuana which they seized, which had a value of about €3.5 million. And it was being sold and distributed not just within this region, but further afield as well in other countries in Europe, such as the Netherlands and Germany.
Guy Delaunay. Investment in solar power is forecast to exceed investment in oil this year. That's according to the International Energy Agency. But spending on polluting, climate-changing fossil fuel energy is still forecast to be about $1 trillion. Tim Gould, the chief energy economist for the IEA, spoke to Tim Franks about the significance of the figures.
We are convinced that the clean energy economy is emerging, and it's actually emerging much faster than many thought. 5 years ago, there was roughly $2 trillion being invested in the energy sector. So half of it was going to fossil fuels and roughly half going into a range of clean energy technologies. And our latest numbers show that we're still investing around $1 trillion in fossil fuels. But we expect that this year we're going to be investing about $1.7 trillion in clean energy. So that's a really substantial increase and a big change in the energy landscape.
Does it matter how evenly this investment in renewables is spread around the world? Or is it just one of those things where, frankly, if loads is going into one place, it doesn't really matter because the world benefits?
I think the world benefits whichever way we look at it. But it does matter the fact that this is actually spread quite unevenly, because pretty much all of the increase that we've seen over recent years in clean energy investment has come from advanced economies, from the US, from the EU, to a degree from Japan, and then also from China. And outside that grouping, so other emerging developing economies, we haven't seen the same takeoff. It matters because the countries that are not seeing that increase are also the ones that are going to see rapid growth in energy demand. So it's very important that we see a much more broad-based increase in clean energy spending. The quicker that we can build up a new clean energy economy, the quicker we would also be able to manage our energy needs without fossil fuels. So those two things are really strongly interdependent. If you try and phase down fossil fuels without building up alternatives, you're also going to run into difficulties. It means that it would be an extremely bumpy ride. And we've seen over the last 2 years that where you do have shortfalls in fuel supply, that affects the vulnerable first. And if that's true within our societies, and it's true internationally, many of the poorest import-dependent countries had a very difficult time over the last 2 years during the global energy crisis. So I think we need to make sure that we are meeting that demand for energy services, but make sure we're meeting it in a sustainable way.
Economist Tim Gould. Two young Moroccan entrepreneurs are hoping to create the first African-designed and engineered electric car with their company, the Atlas E Mobility Group. Our Africa regional editor Richard Hamilton reports.
The company was founded by 24-year-old Mohamed Yehya El Bakali and his business partner Hisham Senhaji Hanoun. They hope to build vehicles and their electric batteries at a new factory in Morocco. The North African country has already transformed itself into a car-making hub for multinationals such as Renault and aims to produce 1 million vehicles a year. These young Moroccan businessmen are currently in discussions with established international car manufacturers so that they can join forces to produce Africa's first electric car. But Mohamed Yehya El Bakali says the interior will have a traditional and distinctive Moroccan design.
The car we're looking to build is going to be a premium SUV, so a sport utility vehicle. And it will be built on an established car manufacturer platform. So it will be an existing EV platform that we'll be using, while the body style and the interior will be entirely inspired by Moroccan design and identity. And that's what we really want to offer, something that has a very attractive, unique spirit that reflects the identity of a nation.
Mohamed and Hisham also hope to be involved in developing Africa's electric infrastructure. They admit that there are now three main challenges: range, how far you can drive before you need to recharge; infrastructure, the availability of charging points; and last but not least, affordability. But they say they're confident the company can overcome these challenges and produce cars for Africa's expanding middle classes, not just the rich elite. There have been announcements about similar projects by other companies in the past, but so far none of them have reached the production stage. Production of the Atlas E-Mobility Group vehicles is planned to start in 2026.
Richard Hamilton reporting. Still to come here on the Global News Podcast.
All these trees are dead in front of us.
Yeah, all these trees. This is all dead.
It's a little bit like a horror film.
Why so many trees are dying in Germany. Welcome back. A court in Pakistan has handed 16 civilians over to the military for trial for their suspected involvement in violence sparked by the arrest of the former Prime Minister Imran Khan. Thousands of supporters and several leaders of Mr. Khan's party are in custody in connection with this month's unrest. With more details, here's our South Asia editor Anbarasan Etharajan.
Imran Khan and many of his supporters are now feeling the wrath of the country's powerful military, locally known as the establishment. A government committee approved plans last week to try people accused of attacking military compounds during the unrest under army law. Military courts operate under a separate system from civilian courts. Trials are closed to outsiders and the media. Rights groups have criticized the trials, saying they violate an individual's right to due process. Several senior leaders have decided to quit Mr. Khan's party, seemingly after coming under pressure while in detention. Mr. Khan now has few allies at home or abroad, but the former cricket captain has vowed to fight till the last ball. The ongoing turmoil coincides with Pakistan's worst economic crisis in decades. Record high inflation, dwindling foreign currency reserves, and poor economic growth have triggered concerns that the country could default on its external loan obligations.
Anbarasan Etharajan. Racist abuse hurled at a black Real Madrid football player during a match on Sunday has unleashed global outrage and a debate in Spain about tolerance for racism. The Valencia club, where the incident took place, has already been fined and ordered to close off one of the stands in the stadium for several matches. It's not the first time that the Brazilian player Vinicius Jr. has been targeted. He's frequently criticised the lack of action taken by the Spanish football league La Liga. But its head, Javier Tebas, says his organisation needs more power.
Estamos convencidos.
We are convinced that if we had those powers, within months we would get rid of this problem, or at least we would improve it considerably in general, and specifically in the case of Vinicius. But if we don't have the powers, all we can do is file complaints.
There's been a great deal of international attention directed at the incident, including from the Brazilian president, all saying something must be done. A correspondent in Madrid, Guy Hedgeco, told me more about what Mr. Tebas had to say.
You put your finger on it a bit there when you mentioned the international attention brought to this and the backlash back in Brazil, which is Vinicius's home country, because there was a feeling today with the president of La Liga that this was something of a damage limitation exercise. He's trying to help restore Spain's reputation when it comes to the issue of race in sport after a very difficult week for him and for the country, you could argue. He was trying to outline today the efforts that he says he and La Liga have made over recent years to try and battle racism in the sport. He says that, you know, he doesn't have enough powers to sanction or to punish people who are found to have racially insulted players in stadiums. But he says within the powers that La Liga has, they've done a lot. They've detailed 8 or 9 occasions when Vinicius Jr. himself was racially abused just this season alone in different stadiums around the country. But he says that other institutions, the Football Federation and prosecutors and others, have not acted on the complaints that La Liga has made. So this is very much Mr. Tebas defending his own actions in this area.
And what about racism in Spain outside football?
Well, I mean, we're right in the middle of an election campaign. On Sunday, we have local elections across the country. So that has sort of slightly inflamed this issue even further, because an issue like this tends to be very divisive in Spain. And I think it's divided opinions on this issue. Recent studies have shown a slightly alarming number of young people, for example, who are intolerant of people of other colours, other ethnicities. And that's been talked about a lot. So there has been a lot of debate about whether politics, wider politics, whether the presence of the far right in Spain, whether those issues are feeding into the idea of racism in sport and specifically in football.
Guy Hedgeco. The UN has called for the protection of a Palestinian village in the occupied West Bank after human rights groups say residents have been driven off the land due to repeated Israeli settler attacks as well as home demolitions by the authorities. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Tom Bateman.
This week, nearly 200 residents of the village of Ain Samia gathered up their children, the last of their belongings, and even began dismantling their own homes, forced to flee, say rights groups, due to what they describe as their lives being made unbearable. Residents say violence and intimidation by Israeli settlers has spiralled in the last year, and Israeli authorities have repeatedly demolished homes with a European Union-funded school due to be knocked down too. The UN has called on Israel to protect the community, while the EU said it was appalled by the violence. Israeli authorities declined to comment to the BBC, but routinely say demolitions are due to a lack of building permits, even though these are almost impossible for Palestinians to get. Meanwhile, residents of another village, Berka, in the north of the West Bank, reported homes and property being torched in a separate attack by settlers on Wednesday. Palestinians believe a surge in settler violence has happened, with perpetrators feeling emboldened by the fact their ideological leaders, the pro-settler far right, are now in top Israeli government positions.
Tom Bateman. Experts are warning that drought and hotter summers are killing Germany's spruce forests. They're a staple of the timber industry, but are proving unable to cope with the consequences of climate change. Caroline Bailey reports from one of the worst affected areas, the Harz Mountains.
All these trees are dead in front of us.
Yeah, all these trees. This is all dead. It's a little bit like a horror film.
The view from the Harz Mountains in northern Germany is devastating. Andreas Mehling, who's head of the tourist office in nearby Wernigerode, says until recently the slopes were densely carpeted with dark green spruce trees, but no longer. Every summer, a survey of the state of Germany's trees is carried out across the country. It's collated for the government by Dr. Nicole Velbrock of the Thunen Institute. The results for last year were published this spring, with 4 out of 5 trees showing signs of damage, ranging from loss of foliage to having died. This is being blamed on climate change, and it's not just spruce that are affected.
There are some areas where also beech are dying, but it's suffering. Also oak is suffering. There's no really tree species which we can say it's well growing.
And although the last couple of years have seen more rain, this hasn't been enough to compensate for the damage already done since 2018. The German government is spending €900 million on grants for forest owners to replant mixed forests. Not for pure spruce, though, which aren't native to Germany and like cool, wet climates, but different species which it's hoped will be more resilient to hotter temperatures.
But Peter Volleben, a well-known forester and writer of best-selling books about trees, blames commercialised forestry and the timber industry for the dire state of some of Germany's forests.
We are losing every year 1,500 square kilometres. And why? Because of planting non-native trees, of making plantations. It's like battery farming.
Surely they've got to replant these forests.
No, that's the biggest mistake ever. You can't plant a forest, you can just make a plantation. Let do nature the job. Trees are able to repair forest ecosystems since 300 million years.
Peter Volleben wants to see a much smaller timber industry. But Christian Meyer, who buys and sells wood for the agricultural products group RWZ, says it's important that the proportion of softwood trees, which includes spruce, doesn't fall below 50%.
Mr. Volleben has to explain where he thinks the timber and wood products will come from, if not from German production. I think it would be a shame if sites are taken out of production in Germany and the forest is just left to its own devices.
Opinion is divided in Germany on which approach to take. But in the meantime, how will Andreas Mehling in the Harz Mountains attract visitors? You can't exactly advertise your dead forests, can you?
Perhaps I have to do that because we will see these dead trees the next years. And perhaps it's a very special attraction, yes? You can see climate change and perhaps you can learn something for yourselves and you can do at home something better.
That report by Caroline Bailey. Scientists are closely watching a pod of killer whales in the waters off Spain and Portugal, which are apparently being taught how to damage small boats by an older female orca called White Gladys. In the past month alone, three vessels have sunk after being pursued by the mammals, and researchers have recorded more than 500 cases of the whales reacting to boats in the 3 years since they began observing the group. Monica Gonzalez is a marine biologist with a non-governmental organisation in northwest Spain, which is monitoring the behaviour of the Iberian orcas.
Since 2020, our subpopulation of Iberian orcas started to approach to the boats and started to interact with them, touching the boats and usually touching the rudders. They are doing this because they are intelligent animals and they know what parts of the boat they have to touch to stop the boat.
And why do you think they're doing this?
We have two hypotheses about why they are doing this. First is they are playing, it's a self-induced behavior. The second hypothesis is that one orca suffer an adverse event. It's an adult female. We name as Gladys Blanca, White Gladys. And we think that the correct option is the second hypothesis, the adverse event, because this Gladys was the unique adult who started interactions. When the interactions started, all of orcas who interact were juveniles. In the strait, there are a lot of orcas who are specialized in hunting tuna on fishing lines and increase their curiosity if an orca see these fishing lines. And last year, we saw an orca with a fishing line stuck in its body. So all these arguments lend us to think that the hypothesis of the adverse moment, the adverse event, happened is the correct.
So she had a bad experience with a boat and she's teaching younger orcas to attack the boat. Is that your hypothesis?
We don't consider the word attack because attack is trying to hurt somebody. Orcas don't want to hurt somebody, only want to stop the boat. In many cases, they break the rudder, but for us, it's not an attack. And these orcas could think that it's necessary for their survival.
So do scientists think this is going to become learned behaviour and all the orcas that associate with White Gladys are going to do this?
All these 39, only 15 interact with boats, always the same 15. Two adults and the rest are juveniles. It's like a cultural behavior. It's like when we get up in the morning and do some coffee every morning. It's a routine. And from orcas, it's a routine. When an orca gets up, the orca thinks about, I have to swim 50 kilometers, for example. I have to eat and I have to stop some boats. And it's a routine, and they always do the same every day. So if White Gladys was dead, nothing changed.
Marine biologist Monica Gonzalez. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Stuart Willey and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
How did we grow our business internationally? Expand our production facilities. Make new connections and secure financing to go from this to this? We saw the future, and Export Development Canada helped us map the way.
Looking to grow your business globally? Confidently enter new markets, reduce financial risk, and grow your business with Export Development Canada. Discover the export impact at edc.ca today.